jazz.
Busted.
Let's knock this podcast out. You're going to do most of the talking.
Once again.
Chime in. Sorry.
It's listen, okay.
No one wants to, you know, if this was a sexier voice, that would be great. But it's not. It's just kind of scary. It's just sort of a scary voice. If it was all sexy and shit, I'd be like, hey.
Hey, baby.
I sound like sandpaper.
It's kind of a hoarse, obscene phone call, not the kind you want to get at 3 a.m. So.
Yeah, it's not a good obscene phone call. It's a sad obscene call. You're like, the guy is like heavy breathing. You're like, you want a lozenge?
That's right. What are you wearing? I don't know. I don't really care that much. I just feel tired.
I just feel bad.
Yeah. Do you have any warm milk? Yeah.
Can you send some soup over? I'll leave you alone. That's right. Heavy breathing for soup.
There you go. All right. Well, welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 133. It's official. It's a real one. I'm Pat.
And I'm Mike.
Yeah. That,
or a piece of it.
That's right. Mike is...
Did you explain to them last time?
I sure did.
My voice was bad.
So yeah, as you know, listeners, loyal listeners, we had a bonus episode, a 132.5 episode last time where I discussed in excruciating detail Duke Ellington's Suites. Because Mike was ill, and Mike is still fighting off this really nasty, virulent strain of the flu, but he's willing to try to get through this episode. So this is really the first time we've been together kind of in the old style way for a while, since the previous episode was the interview with Charles McPherson, which I think went swimmingly well, and I'm real glad that took place. And I'm hoping to see Charles in March, I believe, he comes to Scandinavia. So anyway, this is just a standard issue, kind of random things on our playlist podcast. We've got a lot of interesting things planned as the year unrolls, but right now we're just going to kind of talk about some music that came across our desks. I think one of the pieces was inspired by a very flowery, very enthusiastic review in the New York Times. And is that right? The next album?
Yeah, the New York Times Magazine.
Magazine, thank you. Their album from 2009, Silver Water. I guess that's not the worst kind of water, I suppose. And then you also picked, I call him Alex Sippin' Gin.
Stop that.
After Snoop Dogg. But how do you actually say this Russian trumpeter's last name? Because I had to mispronounce it twice. You know, I did it at the end of the Charles episode, thinking we'd be doing it next. Failed to do that. Then I did it at the end of my Sweet special. So how do you say this man's name?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Sippyagin.
Ah, there we go. If I just included the yacht, it would have been okay.
Yeah.
And this is a 2005 release on Crisscross. He has been with that label quite a while.
Yeah.
He is pretty much our contemporary, I think born the same year that Mike was. Very handsome, well-preserved man, just like both of us are.
I was going to say, are you talking about me?
And then I picked a couple, again, kind of randomly. One that kind of ties in with the last podcast, the Vienna Art Orchestra's Duke Ellington Sound of Love from 2000. This is a group I not listened to much. I enjoyed this production, and a couple of the tunes on it came from some of Ellington's Suites. And then I'm going to butcher the name of this album, Julie Wood's Cinque Mezza from 2005.
Well done.
It is a collection of Finnish folk songs done as jazz. And since I'm in Scandinavia right now, though not in Finland, I thought, you know, let's bring this up. It's an album I've kind of been fond of for a number of years. I don't know what you thought of it, but it kind of slots neatly into that blanket fort place for me.
I have another word for it, but okay.
Okay. Well, we'll see how things go here. Maybe Mike will get feistier as we go along. So I do you have any preference where we dig in here, the usual chronological trawl?
Well, let's generate some energy right here at the beginning. Let's start with the necks. Let's start with these bastards. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
These guys.
So this is like an Australian trio, The Necks, and they've released a series of albums over their fairly lengthy career. I've only heard this in parts of, I think, their most recent release, which sounded to the untrained ear a bit like Silver Water.
Yes. So these guys came to my attention because of Jeff Dyer, who is a novelist by trade. I believe he's British, and has been an expatriate, has spent time here in the United States. We've talked about him before because in addition to writing novels, Jeff Dyer is very into jazz, and he wrote a book on jazz, which we talked about, or alluded to at least, in some earlier podcast, where he kind of ventriloquizes, he sort of short storifies certain sort of well-known anecdotes from...
And that was like But Beautiful, is that right?
Jazz history. So Monk...
But one T, But Beautiful.
I think that's right, yeah. And so there's a story about... Exactly. And there's a moment, you know, where Monk trying to get into a motel, and Art Pepper coming off the smack, and a handful of others that sort of dramatize. There's one, Harry Carney and Duke Ellington driving across country, right? So these are sort of fictionalized versions of real life stories from jazz. So anyway, Jeff Dyer is a kind of enthusiast about the music, and I have a mixed view of Dyer's love for the medium. I like some of the things he says, but other things I don't like. Anyway, he wrote this long, insanely enthusiastic piece about the Necks, this trio from Australia, in which he waxes superlatively eloquent about their spontaneous, simultaneous improvisation, and on and on and on and on. And so I thought, all right, let's dig this up and listen to it. So I got a hold of Silverwater, which is a single take, one song, an hour and 7 minutes and 15 seconds long. And I have to say that while I admire Jeff Dyer, I'm not sure he knows what the fuck he's talking about sometimes. So what did you make of this? I'll tell you what I made of it. I certainly don't think there's a second coming, the new wave in jazz. I think Jeff Dyer has wildly overstated the case here. But,
and he calls them...
I do like this,
right.
But...
He calls them something like the greatest trio in the world or something like that.
Not even close. Not even close.
You know.
They're very good.
And, of course, that's the burden he's placing on them. I don't think they advertise themselves that way or something. Yeah, it's a really a kind of traditional piano trio, but there are also some guitar passages and some, I assume, organ or electronic keyboard passages.
Right, overlays and so forth,
generated by the three musicians. I don't have their names in front of me, but it's a long-standing ensemble. They do play with other musicians because in the world of jazz, there's almost no ensembles that are completely self-sustaining economically. It's just not possible. You typically have to work with multiple groupings to kind of and make a living. You know, I was playing this for just out on the speakers, and Joyce asked me, what is this stuff? Does Mike hate you? Is he mad at you? As she sometimes does. It is very, I guess, it's like knock, and then you wait 20 minutes, knock, and then you wait another 20 minutes. Who's, you know, it's like the world's slowest burn. The punchline is coming, but it's going to be a long time. It is sustained tension. It's minimalism. Right. It's drone music. It's glacial movement. I will say it grew on me. I think I like it better now than when I first listened to it because the mind is aching for some kind of progression, some kind of development, and it's not going to get that.
Right.
And so once you've kind of taught it the contours of this 70-minute performance, it starts to kind of have its own internal logic and make sense, and you aren't impatiently waiting for, say, a second chord and can kind of enjoy what's going on in front of you to the best of your ability. I don't think it's a second or third coming of anything. I think it is interesting. I think it's very, very specialized music with very, very tight aims. And on those grounds, I think it works pretty well. It is kind of got its own fascination. I listened to it a couple times in my kind of giant Marvin the Martian headphones. And it does, I think, especially on the second or third or fourth listen, when you've got the contours in your head, rewards that kind of attention. For one thing, at one point, I did not get the minute count. It's like in the background, way, way layered back to almost inaudible quietness. It's like there's this really frantic keyboard solo going on. So it's like there's little details. It's a kind of, you know, you could pore over it the way some people obsess about Kubrick movies, you know. There's so little apparently going on the surface. You could kind of rabbit warren your way down into the depths and obsess about it if you wished. And just as a sound, you know, the sound of the drums is very visceral. You know, when he's playing these very simple patterns again and
Yes.
again, the bass is woody and present. So it is just sonically pleasing to listen to. So on those terms, I liked it. I just can't, I don't know whether there's something magical about experiencing something like this unfold in real time, maybe with chemical help. I like it. I don't quite get where Dyer's orgasmic obsession with this music is the best thing in the world and life-changing and all the rest of it comes from. But, you know, I don't think it's without merit or a complete dead end. It's just I'd hate it to be a large portion of my musical diet. I mean, it's only giving you certain things. Very exquisitely prepared, but it's like the world's best wasabi peas, but nothing but them. And that's a
Right.
snack. It's not a meal.
It reminds me a lot of, the people who like this are going to be, if you're the kind of person who thinks Dark Side of the Moon is the greatest orchestral rock ever, you will really like this. And I do like this, but I guess Dyer's over-the-top praise for them really put my back up. And if I hadn't read him on them, I'd like them even a little better, I think. This is very enjoyable. But for example, if you look under the Rate Your Music listing for this album, they call it avant-garde jazz. Okay, that's fine. And they call it free improvisation. And I'm thinking, not sure I'm going to go there. This feels terribly scripted. This feels incredibly planned out. It does not feel like free improvisation at all. The stuff happens at a glacial pace, and there's a kind of logic and order and progression to the interventions that the musicians make. I mean, for example, the kind of pulse, there's a kind of the sort of rhythmic pulse that happens, and it slowly fades out to be replaced by something else. But you can still hear the overtones of that rhythmic pulse in the new iteration that the music begins to take. That's not random. That's not unplanned. That's orchestrated. I mean, this feels orchestrated, not to within an inch of its life, because it has a kind of organic flow to it, the way like a lava lamp does, right? But a lava lamp, it's a very specific kind of flow, right? The bubbles in the lava lamp go up and then they go down and they sort of collect and then they disperse. They don't break outside the frame of the lava lamp and form spontaneous lava sculptures on the floor of your living room. There's a lot of structure and order in this free-flowing piece. So it does have a kind of organicism. It feels organic, and yet within a very limited range. It's not organic in the sense of, wow, this is, you never know what's going to happen next. That's not true. You kind of do know what's going to happen next. I do think it kind of grows on you. I do like it. When it came up, when I first listened to it, I was like, and then after the fourth or fifth listen, you get a little used to it, and you kind of anticipate some of the changes and some of the moves. But this is very drony. It's very much in that sort of drone bag, minimalist bag. So if you hate that stuff, if you're like, when's the melody going to happen? This is not for you. This is definitely something you could put on and completely chill to. Like it could be on in the background while you're doing other stuff. Right? We talk sometimes about dog and cat jazz. This is cat jazz to the millionth degree. Like you could put this on and just forget about it and just do other stuff. But if you were paying attention to it, I think you would find pleasures in it, and you would find variations in the repetition, and you could kind of lose yourself in it. And yeah, I could totally see chemical substances helping one's appreciation of this music. I could completely see someone going, "Oh yeah, I saw God." I get that. I get that. But sitting there sipping coffee, listening to it. It didn't change my life. Let's put it that way. I liked it a lot, but I didn't see God. Let's put it that way. So this is enjoyable. I think it's interesting. I think Dyer's claims are inflated. And I like Dyer. And I love his enthusiasm. But I wish I had read him before I listened to this, because I probably would like this just a little bit more than I do. But when someone makes these outsized claims for music like this, I'm thinking, this is the kind of music I play for someone who's really into prog rock, and I'm trying to interest them in jazz, you know, and be like, hey, why don't you try this?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Pink Floyd, because I was kind of thinking of Richard Wright's Organ Textures. And, you know, Floyd tended to work at their best with really simple building blocks. And I'd say my favorite by far is Wish You Were Here. You know, they produce something kind of neat out of those. But yeah, you don't put down one of their albums thinking, man, this is a bunch of virtuosos, or my God, they're in the outer reaches of space and, you know, expanding the cosmos with their playing kind of thing. They're really good at creating a mood using pretty basic materials. Yeah. Very much music of, it's like they're improvising a play, quote unquote, but they can only, we're allowed to use 8 words or something. You know, Well, the rule set is so incredibly simple that, yes, I mean, you can, you know, put all the textures in the background you want. You can decide just how long you want to repeat that piano chord. And the answer is, spoilers, a really long time. Or, or you can play that bass figure again and again. And I do find, I mean, I like performances in the jazz realm that have sometimes these bass ostinatos that just kind of hypnotically unwind for 6, 7, 8 minutes long. I think those can really be effective if they're played with the right care and engagement. And I think that works here. I don't feel like, you know, when he plays that figure again and again, I don't feel like it droops or it loses point or it kind of wanders off or it just gets dull. But it is finally, it's, you know, they can sustain tension forever. It's kind of tantric jazz.
Yeah, that's a good word.
For that, it's fine. But it's weird because Dyer both did them a service in that he made them more discoverable, and that is probably the number one problem listeners to jazz have. I was reading Downbeat somewhere. Somebody said, I bet you work for Downbeat, you probably get like 25 inquiries a week over there. And he's like, no, I get like 100 things a day. So, I mean, there's just so much music out there. It's just unbelievable how much is being produced, much of it at a pretty high level. And an article like this says, well, good grief, this guy is really passionate in a pretty, you know, national organ, a well-known magazine about this group. It's worth looking up. But at the same time, he just goes so over the moon about them that, yeah, you kind of come gunning for him. You know, it's like, okay, so this is better than Bill Evans. You know, bring it on. And I don't think that part doesn't do him a service. So I'd recommend listening to it unless, again, you just hate static, droning music, because it'll drive you up the fucking wall. But, you know, I learned after a while, if you listen to Revolution Number 9 often enough, it kind of makes a sense. And the sense of it is a sequence of events that you've learned and almost memorized, and then you can anticipate. Exactly. And then you begin to appreciate them just as events without asking anything more from them other than you're going to now hear this backward mass passage or this chant or whatever. You, in a sense, are providing the narrative. You know, I guess the narrative was stapled together, but the sense of the narrative is coming entirely from your memory. And, you know, that I don't listen to Revolution Number 9 all the time, but there you go. I mean, it's there's something there, but it's not the highest thing I can get from music. Life is short, so I'm probably not going to spend it very often compared to my favorite Beatles stuff, where a lot more is happening. So, yeah, thanks for bringing it up. I mean, I never heard of them, and I did read most of the article, skimmed bits of it. And, yeah, it was, I think, rhetorically, it didn't quite work. It asked too much of the reader in terms of just being too partisan and a little bit too, I don't know, wide-eyed, and maybe literally,
Yeah.
maybe he drops some acid at Pete's
But
expense.
I mean, to give Jeff Dyer props, he loves the music and he writes about it passionately. And if he gets 1,000 people more interested in the Necks and they find their way to Bill Evans, that's awesome. Just, like you said, the claims are a little overinflated, and if you take them at their literal meaning, they can really get under your skin. But if you just sort of filter that out a little bit and say, okay, he really likes this
There you
band,
go.
why?
Right.
You might find something here that doesn't make you throw up in your
And
mouth a little
again,
bit.
not the Next fault. Right. I mean, it's this weird thing where, you
Yeah.
can have the wrong fan base and then it's
Right.
not their fault. Well, who do you want to do next? Who is up here?
Let's just kill my selections and we'll move on to yours. Let's do Alex Sipiagin's returning next.
Okay.
So. I'll say a little bit about where I know him
Sure.
from and
Okay.
why I picked this up. So I became aware of him, I don't know when it was. Oh gosh, I do know when it was. Back in 2000 or so, I got interested in the Mingus Big Band and the Mingus Dynasty, two separate legacy bands connected to the music of Charles Mingus. And Alex Sibiagin, he's a Russian, and he came to the States, I think, somewhere in the 90s. So he's a Russian trumpet player. Plays trumpet and flugelhorn on this particular album. And he was deeply involved in both of those projects. I actually went back and listened to one of the Mingus Legacy projects, Gunslinging Birds, just to kind of, remind myself of where my interest in him came from. So he is someone who I was aware of through those legacy bands, which are actually pretty good. Whenever you say legacy band, I guess we ought to be careful when we say that, because there's legacy bands that are just carrying on the name of the founder and not really doing anything new and doing the book, and then bands that have a high caliber of improvisation and engagement with the music that feel fresh and new, that their contributions to the ongoing reputation of the founder are, they're not, it's not just museum pieces, they're actually creating new stuff. And both of those Mingus bands, I think, fit that description. So anyway, that's where I knew him from. And I can't remember where I saw this. I might have picked it up for the quintet anniversary. I might have found it then, because this is a quintet. In any event, I recognized the name and I was like, oh wow, I've never heard anything where he's the leader. So that's why I picked it up. So it's got Alex Sibiagin on trumpet and flugelhorn, Seamus Blake, who I don't think we've ever really talked about on tenor sax, Adam Rogers on guitar, Scott Colley, who I think we have talked about, on bass, and Antonio Sanchez on drums. And as you pointed out, it's on the Criss Cross label, which he's been with like forever. So what did you think of this? Did you like this or what?
Yeah, this is the toughest selection for me this week because I think it's the production more than anything else. And the production is saying, very, very pleasant, don't pay attention, Patrick. And it's not super slick. Everything is kind of burnished. And I like it. And when I listen to it, I think, yeah, that's really a fairly compelling melody, or hey, that's a pretty good solo kind of thing. But if I don't kind of laser focus in on it, it just slips to the periphery of my consciousness. And I've got one other leader date by him with like some female vocals on a couple of the tracks, and it too is good. So yeah, I don't quite, and it's my fault rather than his. I don't have a sense of him so much yet as an as improvising voice. And it's very different. I mean, because those Mingus projects, maybe we could call the old band name bands just, brand name bands, right? It's literally,
Right.
this is a name. You've heard of Count Basie. This is the thing that has that brand name. Whereas I think the Mingus bands were serious about carrying on his legacy, and they generate their own excitement. They don't just reflect it from hearing something familiar.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why some of those bands, I think we talked about that in the podcast where we discussed the Mel Lewis, Thad Jones bands.
There is something kind of loud back where you are. What was that? Some kind of hissing sound?
Yeah, that would be the water pipes in my building.
Okay.
I apologize for the pipes.
It's okay. This, in a sense, epitomizes my reaction to this record, which is I like it. It's very well done. It's good stuff, but I'm easily distracted from it.
Right.
So, you know, I don't feel like I've given this guy his full due. I've listened to the record repeatedly, and every time I listen to it, I enjoy it. But it is the one that seems the least distinctive to me, and I don't have a sense yet of Alex's personality on the horn, other than he's a very polished, kind of mellow-sounding player, at least in this context. Very different from the relatively raw sound the Mingus Big Band would get. It's right. Like there's a screen or two of Vaseline between you and the music. And that may be partially just his aesthetic, and some of it may have to do with engineering decisions. Again, it's a great album to play. I think you could put it on for any guest, and they would not be disturbed by it. I just don't. And it's not like I'm saying it's easy listening or just playing it. Not at all. I mean, it's substantive jazz. In some ways, the tunes may be a little abstract for my taste. It's kind of in that, you know, slightly oblique post-bop mode where you don't really hear any blue notes or real straightforward familiar progressions, and everything kind of, again, slightly at an angle, but it's never atonal. There's never anything that leaps out at you or is abrasive. So that's my take.
So yeah, my feeling on this is I do like Alex Sipiagin as a soloist, even here. I agree with you. It does feel like there's some Vaseline on the lens. He and Seamus Blake on most of the numbers get up to one of two things. Either they play interlocking lines that aren't exactly mirroring each other, but are kind of chasing one another. These aren't quite ECM ballads, but they aren't burners either.
Yeah.
They're in that sort of mid-up-tempo range, and if I have a complaint, it's that all the songs kind of fall into that mid-up-tempo range. They sound a little bit alike in that respect. And so Blake and Sipiagin, they have lots of lines that sort of intertwine until one or the other drops out, and then we get a solo. And Sipiagin is a very fleet, very polished player. This isn't super burning fast. He's not showing off in that sense. So the speed that he gets up to on his solos isn't meant to overshadow the rest of the song. And the same thing is true of Blake on his solos. Otherwise, they follow the kind of bebop mode of statement, and then everyone gets a go. The thing that I kind of don't need here, or the thing that doesn't work for me very much, and he's a fine player, but Adam Rogers' guitar kind of distracts from what's happening here. I would have preferred this almost as a quartet. In fact, I think it's the guitar that's responsible for smearing some of the Vaseline on the lens. Two of the numbers here, most of the numbers are by Sipiagin. One is by Rogers, and of course there's the Bill Evans tune. But there are two Pat Metheny numbers here, and that to me is kind of indicative of the bag that we're in. This is Pat Metheny in his strummier mood, right? And the whole album kind of has that feel. Rogers isn't burning up anything on this album, and a lot of times his playing feels to me, he's a good player. It's just, it feels like it kind of smoothing out, as you pointed out, the rougher edges here. I think Sipiagin and Blake could strike more sparks than they do, but there's always this sort of fairly heavy, sustained guitar licking in the back that just kind of smooths it all out a little bit. And I guess my other regret here is I think Scott Colley is a hell of a bassist, and he has a really nice plummy sound, and he doesn't get too many numbers where you can sort of just hear him. You have to have the big boy headphones on and really try to pay attention to him. I think he's put down in the mix a little bit more than I would like, and so on. The number that strikes me, I like his solo late in the third number on the album, Miniature, and he gets a chance to kind of stretch out for a minute, and you're like, I would like more of this. This would be good. So I sort of feel like this is a little bit like the, it's and you're right, it's very smooth, it's very polished, and it, I guess I want to add by subtracting. I guess I want to take Rogers out of the mix so I can hear everyone else a little bit more and hear a little bit more friction than what I get here. And, you know, maybe that's just asking this to be something different than it is. You know, it is what it is, which is really, really high-level stuff. I really think Sibiaghan and Blake, their playing is quite good here. They're definitely the featured players on the album. But I guess I want a little more friction and fire and something that feels a little bit more like Risk than polish. And, you know, maybe that's just not what they were going for. And what they went for is perfectly good, but there was enough here that made me wish for other things or for things to be a little more heated than they turn out to be here. Maybe a blues, maybe a Mingus number, just some raw Fables of Phoebus wouldn't have come amiss. Just something.
Well, I was telling you, you mentioned they don't really do a full-on ballad. I mean, there are, I guess, a couple more.
Right.
Because they don't really do the ECM float. I mean, to me, good ECM comes in a variety of flavors, but one of them is when they're doing this a little bit slower, driftier music, and it works emotionally for me. I mean, it's everybody's subjective take. And right. They don't quite go that dreamy, but they also don't go folksy the way that Methaney in his more interesting moments sometimes does. It's,
right.
Again, it's that kind of generic is kind of harsh, but that, you know, very advanced, very polished post-bop sound, but nothing super distinctive. It's hard to imagine a Jeff Dyer-like figure deciding this was the greatest quintet
right.
in the world. As well as it'd be
right.
very hard to imagine anybody saying this was not a very fine quintet.
Exactly.
But, you know, at some point you're just like, well, what's moving me about this? Where's the emotional engagement? What's grabbing me? And I you know, again, I like it. And I can certainly imagine trumpet players listening at, you know, admiringly to this and saying, boy, I want to think about some of the strategies on display here and marvel at the control, but it doesn't necessarily reach me.
Yeah, it's like the quintessential 3.5-star album. It's better than run of the mill. It's not a classic. It's good. And it has glimmers of things that make you wish for more.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that a lot of Sibiaghan's output kind of falls, and I want to dip into him more deeply. But I'm going to guess that this is, I mean, because this sounds so comfortable and polished. Like, you don't get this sound first time
right.
out. This is something that you kind of, like, you find a bag, and this is your bag. This is what you do. And this is where he lives. There's a sense that this is a house that he knows the contours of really, really well. Not a place that he just built on the fly. So I have a sense that his albums may sound like this, and I guess I would be shocked to find out that they were, that his discography had a lot of different things in it. But I'm going to find out. I'm going to like listen to his stuff and report back. But I got a feeling this is kind of what he does. And it's really good, and it makes me wish for more.
And I never know, with this kind of sound, and it's a little reminiscent to me of what I thought of as like the mid-90s jazz sound where everything was just too fucking polished. And I have no idea if that's got anything to do with quote-unquote digital or not. That's not what I'm talking about. Just an engineering approach that everything is very rounded and a little distant, and there's no sense that spit and fingers and tongues were involved with producing the music. I don't know if that's a crisscross house sound or a sound that they bring to Alex's projects, but it's both makes it, you know, this was the easiest record to put on if I just wanted to kind of do something else. And as record for use, it's great. But as a listener for me, I just finally find it almost literally off-putting. It just, it moves me away from the music. I don't engage with it. I enjoy, but don't really cathect. So I like to hear a little more resin on the strings, a little more spit on the reed, which is, wait, I don't necessarily want to hear spit on the reed, but just some more sense of, you know, a woody sound, a brass sound,
yeah.
string sound, drums. I mean, there was a drummer on this album, for sure. I couldn't tell you anything about him. I think he did a fine job, but as opposed to the next, where, I mean, when that guy plays drums, he's fucking playing drums, and you feel it. You may be
yeah.
bored by it, or feel like it doesn't go anywhere, but there is a sense of a taut skin being hit with a stick. Here, it's kind of a report of that taking place in the next county. So, yeah, fine music and great music to put on at a party if you don't want to distract people. But, yeah, I'd prefer him in a rawer context, for sure.
All right. Thank you.
So from what you were saying, this collection of Finnish folk songs, it was conceived as an homage to the Art Farmer album To Sweden with Love, which he recorded in the 60s with Jim Hall in a quartet.
Which we talked about back in the Jim Hall.
I don't think we did To Sweden with Love explicitly, but I could be wrong. Sometimes you remember these things better than I do.
Okay.
It's certainly, you know, it's an album that is not a lapel grabber for me, but it's kind of grown on me. Neither Farmer nor Hall are aggressive in-your-face artists, but both of them have their great pleasures. So anyway, this Chicago area saxophone player, Julie Wood, who plays a number of, you know, plays Barry, plays soprano, but on this particular album, this 6 to tenor, decided she would do an album, I think, honoring her heritage of Finnish folk songs. And I just kind of ran across it randomly, I think at a Chicago Jazz Fest, probably roughly around the year of its release or soon after. And it sounds to me like it's not a favorite of yours, even though it's kind of a favorite of mine. So tell me about your thoughts on this.
No, you mistake me. What did I say that made you think?
I don't know. You sound like you're loaded for bear, that maybe Julie was in your sights there, that she did not give you wood.
No, I guess I'm sorry. No. My take is this is what ECM should be. This is what ECM should be.
Okay.
When you look at the cover of this album, right? When I saw it, I was like, this is an ECM album. And of course it's not. It's an OA2 or whatever that label is. But it looks like an ECM album, right? You've got the name of the artist and it's called Sitka Dark Forest. And there it is. There's sort of a looming dark forest in the mist, and it's sort of blue and gray and reflections, and you think, okay, ECM, Cloud, Clusterfuck, what's his name? What's the guy who runs that label? I was
Manfred Eicher? Eicher?
Yeah, that guy.
Manfred Eicher.
Manfred Eicher. You're like, here we go. We're going to get that shit. But part of the reason we don't is because these are Chicago jazz dudes. Clark Summers on bass, right? You know, so it's not that album at all. This may be inspired by Finnish folk songs, and I feel like at least one of these numbers was turned into something by Sibelius. Mm. I didn't check it, but I feel like Vala Kainen, and that's probably pronounced completely differently, Finns in our massive Finnish listening audience, please forgive me. Anyway, I feel like that I know that from one of Sibelius. Sibelius also took Finnish folk music and turned it into symphonic stuff. I feel like I've heard that or heard parts of that before. That also, I think, might be my favorite number on the album, however the hell it's pronounced. Valiakainen? I don't know. Anyway, so what? This is just a quartet,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
This tenor, guitar.
Bass and drums.
They got this really kind of swinging sound. Some of the numbers have this sort of boozy swinging. It feels like it's kind of a 50s noir TV show and you're driving down a dark alley. These may be inspired by Finnish folk songs, but I don't hear buxom blonde women milking cows when I listen to this, you know? Sorry, Finland. Sorry, our 3 or 2 or no Finnish listeners will send their nasty letters to me saying, you racist bastard. But it may be inspired by that stuff, but this is kind of swinging hip urban jazz, and God, I love her playing. I think she's fascinating. There are passages on these where everyone drops out and she just kind of plays, and everything just has this kind of swing to it. It has this kind of, it's not something I can ignore. Let's put it that way. When this is on, I tend to pay attention. It grabs me. And when everyone drops out and she solos, her solos are not like rip-roaring burners. Like, this is the kind of music you listen to in a club and the lights are down low and she's got blackout shades on and wearing a beret. I mean, I do like this. I think it's pretty cool, and it's just not what you expect. When you see the cover and you see the title and you hear what its inspiration is, you think, okay, here we go. bring on the fog machine. And instead, it's this swinging, cool. It reminds me a little bit of Loop in the Third sometimes. Remember when we did piece not long ago? Yuji Ono? It has that feel sometimes. So I like this. And this is a case where the guitar doesn't spread Vaseline on the lens at all.
No. It's recorded a lot more audio verite. I mean, it's got a great sound.
It sounds like they're in a club. It sounds like it's live recorded. So anyway, say what you think about it. I didn't know anything about this and was just pleasantly surprised by it when I listened to it. But I take it you like it quite a bit.
I do. And I really don't know much about the artist. She's a player in that area. I think she gives clinics. She may give lessons. I may have seen her on the stage one time or another because I've seen so many Chicago musicians over the years. And again, I kind of literally just picked this up on a whim and then was really pleasantly surprised. Yeah, I think that having said they're trying to do an homage and then to really pull it off in a way that seems extremely successful is just kind of, it's both daring and really impressive because it can be hard to go back to that kind of, I don't know, late 50s, early 60s mainstream sound and not make it sound fusty or museum-y. And they seem absolutely inhabiting, committed to artistically fulfilled playing this way, even though it's a style that you don't hear so much anymore. And it's recorded in a style that you don't hear so much anymore without the Vaseline. I feel like you get all the benefits of a club sound, but you don't have to pay the price of uglier muffled sonics. It just sounds very present. I like it a lot. I like the guitar sound. It's like, you know, his amp is in my living room kind of thing. And it's, you know, not in volume, just it's just very, very clear and very present and not doctored or prettied up.
As a player, as a player, who would you compare her to, like, for our listeners? What does she remind you of?
Well, she is not as thorny or sardonic as a Sonny Rollins, but she's definitely somebody who is a thematic improviser, right? She's somebody who plays lines that have melodic sense. Now, they do play at least one of these numbers kind of a la Coltrane. You know, it's kind of a hovering vamp. But again, it's that feel, but she's not going to then elaborate it in a Coltrane-esque manner. She is going to play these sinuous lines that seem to be just perfectly. It's like she really knows these songs, but she's not bored with them. And they push her just enough that she's not coming out with, you know, trite lines or lines that sound like they're written down ahead of time. But boy, she knows exactly where she's taking these lines. I mean, there's a melodic logic to them, and they do hold your ear. I mean, I listen to them like, that's really good. I mean, that's like another verse of this song that's a little bit more complex, but it still has a logic to it. So yeah, I was like, man, this is, you know, she's a really good improviser, you know, and then maybe in a mode that isn't quite as fancy. I mean, I think a lot of people want to sound like shorter on steroids or, you know, something that's more oblique and not so kind of wedded to the chords. But I'm like, I love this stuff. So yeah, I like it a lot. I think the guitar player is definitely listen to some Jim Hall. But again, it's like the best of the Japanese Blue Note homages where you feel like they've really almost transported themselves back to that time. They're really living it. They aren't imitating it. And of course, it's different enough because the music is not all familiar standards. I mean, you know, this same group playing Stella by Starlight might make me kind of sad. I don't know. I might love it.
Right.
But especially with this less familiar material, I think this is a real jam.
I agree. I also think another thing I thought of as I was listening to it was this would make Sophie Fott's highlight reel. Like Sophie would love this because Yuli would lives on the lower end of the saxophone, and that makes her occasional forays of the upper register all that more electric and interesting. None of this stuff is taken at a super fast tempo, and it just has this kind of low swinging feel, and occasionally she'll reach up for those higher notes on the register, but not often, so that makes it special when she does it. And there's just something about her tone, not a lot of vibrato on the sustained notes, There's something really deeply kind of woody or something about her sound. Sorry, I didn't mean to make a pun there, but I like her tone a lot. And occasionally she sort of gets these little trills, or I don't know how to put it. Sort of, I don't know. I just find her very compelling. This is very interesting. And you shared this with me a while back, and I listened to it and it went in and out of my ears, and I wasn't paying that much attention to it. But on this listen and paying attention to it for the podcast, I realized, wow, I need to find out more about this player because I really like this. I don't know about Blanket Fort. Your Blanket Fort is whiter and less cool than this. I don't know.
Yeah, well, this is.
I think if your Blanket Fort is presided over by Paul Desmond, Julie swings too much. She's a little too much funk in her butt.
Yeah, and I was just afraid you might decide that it was too much of that kind of thing. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Again, this is where the Rollins comment. I mean, she is.
Yes.
Right. But again, not maybe quite as sardonic. But yeah, I absolutely agree. She is somebody who, when she plays through the horn, is talking to you. There's that sense that you get to a certain point of time with the instrument, or you don't, because you're just a more emotionally opaque person or whatever. That's not the way you express yourself. And it starts to become another way of kind of speaking. You know, it's the comfort level's there, and she's absolutely got that. So yeah, when she's playing, it is like communicative. It's not just notes. And there's no sense in any of this project, any corner of it, that they're trying to impress anybody or give a fuck what anybody thinks about this. They're just playing it. You know, I don't, because you can't, this is not a project that you could slap down at music school and thrill the kids enrolled with it. They'd say, well, where are the altered chords? And these tempos aren't real fast. And that's not the point of it. They're not trying to impress the music school kids. It's just playing these tunes, saying what they want to say on them. But there's a level of comfort there that it works. I mean, I think it's actually really successful because they're doing what music's supposed to do, which is communicate rather than, I don't know, prove a theory or impress people. Which, you know, I think I feel like with the next as well. It's just I'm a little bit less interested in their message. But, you know, it's I don't think they're trying to prove a point or impress people, I guess, other than their one-man fan club, Jeff Dyer. But, you know, I don't think that's the goal there. But yeah, I I'm glad you liked it. I like it a lot. I was surprised by how much I liked it, I guess. Because, I mean, I think this is still the featured album on her website. So this is not a woman who is prolifically recording as a leader. She's not that well-known a name. She's probably a little bit too old to be lumped in with the hip generation of Chicagoans, you know, now probably in the 30s and 40s that we associate with the kind of the burgeoning third or fourth wave of avant-garde out of there. But boy, you know, I thought this is surprisingly good. Anyway, highly recommended. I think it's a really fun record. And it's just one I just can't imagine you stumbling across. It's odd name, a little known artist. And as you said, it looks ECM-y, but it's not that. The last one kind of ties back into the previous bonus episode or half episode, in that Vienna Art Orchestra's Duke Ellington Sound of Love from 2000 is an ensemble, I guess, based in Austria that I had one of the recording by. They have a long, distinguished recording career. I'm kind of being humbled by how little I know about some of these major European ensembles. They just don't get quite as much play in the States. And again, there's just this incredible, prolific amount of jazz out there that some of it is just kind of contingent based on where you're at and the kinds of things that you happen to run across. But this is obviously a collection of Ellington and Strayhorn tunes done by a pretty much a big band. There is electric guitar, there's a French horn, and two trombone players instead of the usual four, but otherwise it's pretty typical big band personnel. What do you think of this one?
So I do like this. I know them from I have a few other discs by them, so I have From No Time to Ragtime, The Minimalism of Erik Satie. I think I have at least one other of their discs. But I don't remember them well. It's been a long time since I listened to them. I am kind of interested in the European jazz orchestras. What's Alexander Schlippenbach's outfit called? The Global Unity Orchestra. There's a handful of these things, and they're full of European players. And so I got interested in that stuff for a while. But it's been some years before I took an active listen at some of this stuff. So this was a nice return to this music for me. I'll say the one thing I dislike, or the thing that I dislike the most here off the bat, and I don't know if you liked it or not, I don't like the vocals.
I was wondering if that was going to be your
I don't,
yeah.
I don't want the vocals on. So there's a female voice here, you know, like a rocket and rhythm, and I just want her to go away. I actually like the arrangements. I like the energy of the playing. I like that they picked songs that weren't just in the pocket, and they're kind of all over the place. So we get some expected numbers, right? Mood Indigo is here, Rockin' and Rhythm, Take the A Train, and Sophisticated Lady. Okay, fine. And then they get, you know, kind of off the beaten path a little bit, right? Smada is interesting. Blood Count, always like the Billy Strayhorn numbers, so that's cool to have that in there. And then some that I just don't remember. Like you, I'm fairly steeped in the Ellington discography at this point, and yet I just don't remember some of these numbers, and I don't even remember the names. You know, I'm like, really? Okay. So anytime we have a number without a voice, I'm happy. That's like a really good thing. And anytime the voice occurs, I kind of want to stab my eyes out or my ears out. It just really gets under my skin. I don't know why I have such a strong reaction to it. It just really gets on my nerves, and it distracts me from these arrangements, which I think are pretty good. Her voice is the worst for me on I'm Just a Lucky So-and-So.
Right.
As I walk down the street, since everyone I meet gives me a friendly hello, I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so.
There's just something weird about someone. I don't know. I'm going to just sound like such a homer here. But, I mean, she has a recognizable accent. And it really takes me out of the song to hear her do the lyrics here. I don't know who she is. She's a fine singer. There's nothing wrong with her voice. I just don't want it, you know. And the Vienna Art Orchestra is known for its surprising instrumentation, you know, so they don't just repeat Ellington's personnel, do they? Right? I mean, they kind of stretch out, and they're known for having weird things on their albums. I just kind of want to hear them. I just want to hear the band. I just want to hear what they do. To me, for example, Rockin' on Rhythm is a good example. We've talked about this before with Ellington, how he doesn't quite do the harmonies the way you'd expect someone to do, like in the woodwinds or whatever, right? Like he has that weird, slightly astringent sound, and the Vienna Art Orchestra kind of clean up that astringency a little bit, and they replace it with power and brightness. And that's okay. I kind of like that. I think it's kind of interesting. So this isn't... These aren't slavish imitations of Ellington by any stretch. They're recognizable. You know, this is a bright, cheery big band in love with the music and giving it a vibrant, engaged outing. But yeah, just get rid of the vocalist, and I give this an extra half star in my view. I don't know. She really takes me out of the place that I want to be in when I'm hearing this, which is weird because, you know, I do like vocals on Ellington songs. I'm not averse to that. It's just something about this vocalist that gets under my skin. I don't know. Did she bother you? Or?
Yeah, I noticed. And I think especially, you know, I think I'm a lucky so-and-so. I mean, Ellington, And I cannot remember if he did these lyrics or not, but the lyrics of some of his songs, whoever writes them, are sometimes right on the cusp of precious. At the same time, they are supposed to be from an African-American point of view. And then to hear somebody with a European accent sing it, it is odd. And I'm sure that the same, you know, reaction would apply if I tried to sing a Swedish folk song and heavily accented, you know,
sure.
Right. You know, it's an odd thing, but there is a kind of cultural specificity, especially to a tune like that. You know, when she's doing the wordless vocalizing, that's a longstanding tradition in Ellington's music. It doesn't bother me as much. Blood Count, kind of an odd choice to have any vocals with, or the words. It just,
yeah.
That song, which I had not, I guess, not remember that that was the last song that Strayhorn wrote.
Yeah.
It's very moving. Stan Getz was famously great at playing it. I know, I don't remember who was responsible for the words, but it's not a song that needs words. The melody
right.
tells the story there. And so that doesn't really enhance it. But yeah, certainly one thing that I liked about it, and I think it's where I tend to measure Ellington tributes anymore, is, well, you know, do you know this stuff or not? I mean, if you're only doing It Don't Mean a Thing and Mood Indigo and the obvious, you know, Satin Doll, which thank God they didn't do, then I'm a little
yeah.
suspicious of your credentials. But these guys dig deep. Yeah, it opens with Red Garter. I never heard of that song
right.
until I started doing research for the Sweet Special. And on the Ellington Jazz Party and Stereo album, he does this four-part suite called Toot Sweet. Isn't that cute? And the first number of it is Red Garter. And all four of the pieces have Red in the title. The last one is Ready Go, because he's a witty guy. So I, you know, never heard that before. So I now have the original, because I kind of tracked down that record for the special. But yeah, that's pretty obscure. I don't think the Jazz Party is among the first 50 Ellington albums anybody has to get. I mean, I like it a lot, but it's not one of his best known. And after all, it's just I assume a Billy Strayhorn piece, because it appears on, and his mother called him Bill, and then the other recordings I have that are back, you know, the Ellington, Blanton Webster years. But it's, boy, that name is so forgettable, and it's a neat melody line, but it's not his most memorable contour. So that was one that kind of slipped from my memory. And then he does two from Money Jungle. I mean, two of the songs from Money Jungle on this album,
yeah.
None of which are that well known. So both Very Special and A Little Max, which of course ends up being the feature for the drummer. So yeah, just interesting choices. Circle of Fourths, which is the concluding number. They call it Circle in Fourth. I don't know where that came from, but it.
Yeah.
And that's from the end of Such Sweet Thunder. So again, they're using it for the same purpose. The musicianship is a very high level, and they are, I think, pretty distinctive. They have a lot of personality. They've got you get the sense that they are freely expressing themselves. They don't seem boxed in or overly reverent when they play.
Right.
And one of the songs is a guitar trombone duet by the Muthspiel brothers, Wolfgang and Christian.
I know those
Muthspiel,
names.
Yes.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're both Irish.
Yes.
And again, there's little moments there where you can enjoy a couple instruments together. There's a lot of moments with the band in full swing. So they are careful to kind of keep the textures changing. It's not all one intensity level or one cohort of musicians blowing at you 24/7. And the repertoire is really varied, and the energy's there and the fun is there, which I think is really important, because certainly I don't know if you can really address Ellington's music if you don't have some sense of humor. I don't think you have
yeah.
to be puckish like Wynton Marsalis, but I think it's implicit. You know, that's just kind of part of what he does. So yeah, I'd agree that the harmonies are not quite those dense, slightly dissonant, kind of tricky sounds that Ellington does, but I feel like in other ways they kind of bring that edge. It's just a different set of techniques to do it. So
we should also point out this is apparently recorded live to
Absolutely.
An audience,
right?
So that brings another extra sense of energy here. I think that's always a useful thing, and you know, in this context, I think it's definitely a plus.
Right. I mean, these guys are so well trained and so technically secure that you don't get slop, but you do maybe get a little more freedom and energy, which is probably what this group benefited from. Sometimes
yeah.
some of the European bands, not by no means all, you know, you might get a big radio band or whatever, and they're great, but they don't necessarily move you because they're a little too perfect. And yeah, here that helps. unlike so many, you know, the Ellington Jazz Party album, there's applause after every number. And of course, it's entirely a studio artifact. I don't know why Columbia thought it was so important to pretend some of his albums were live when they weren't. It just sounds stupid. But, you know, here you get the sense this is really a group of musicians performing live and, you know, interacting with an audience. Yeah, I don't know them well enough to say this is their best album, but certainly for somebody who's at all familiar with Ellington, it's a great launching place. And I read somewhere some people may think this is, you know, sacrilegious or, you know, like grow up. I mean, this is, I think if you like Ellington, I cannot imagine being offended by anything here.
No. This is definitely for Ellington fans, and they'll like it. And some of the solos are even more high energy than the stuff that Ellington's guys got up to. So I'm thinking of the soprano solo on Very Special.
Right.
Just real energy, real high wire stuff. Not that Ellington's guys couldn't have done that, but we're 40, 50 years on now, and they bring a lot more technique than maybe some of the Ellington guys had at that time. I don't know. It's a lot of energy here. I think it's good.
Yeah, well, of course, these guys have been on the road for 35 years after a while. Like,
there's that,
here
too.
Here we fucking, you know, go again.
They have lives to go home to, and they're not all alcoholics.
There you go. Yeah, well, of course, you'll hear some projects where the solos are all absolutely adequate, but they're fine, but they don't necessarily strike you. I mean, here, I think they're a notch above that, as you say, with energy, with technique, a sense of kind of freedom to express. And when you talk about Rockin' in Rhythm, I mean, it's a well-known Ellington song, but it is the kind of tune that I think you're unlikely to hear many American artists play who aren't in Lincoln Center with Wynton Marsalis in front of them. My sense has been that in jazz in America, there's kind of a dividing line, and really the active history of the music tends to start in the 50s for most players today. They don't tend to reach back in repertoire or technique or approach beyond that. And so a lot of, really, I think Ellington, I suspect, is less played than Monk. I can't prove that, but my sense is that at least for the last few generations of musicians, he's been a more active force. And yeah, that sense that the music from those eras was relevant and was good jazz and was as important and aesthetically valid as stuff that came after Parker, I think is more Europeans seem comfortable with that idea, I think, than many Americans. And certainly my sense is, you know, I keep going back to this, and it's a very crude measure, but if you apply the real book test, there is probably as much Wayne Shorter in there or more than Duke Ellington. You know, it's just that's the sense of, I think of like the working man, jazz persons, the guy that went to the Jamie Ingersoll camp's Bible kind of thing. The canon for jazz is very much Parker forward. So, you know, it's neat to hear groups that respect not only the obscurities like Red Garter from the 50s or 60s, but do go back and, you know, look at some of the earlier stuff. So yeah, I liked it. I mean, I think I liked all the music on the show. Alex was the least memorable to me, and the next are, you know, by far the most in their own corner kind of stuff. But I liked it. You know, I think having heard it, it's something I may go back to again. I don't think I'll play it out loud again if Joyce is around, because it bothers her. And that makes sense, because certain things you expect from music just don't happen. You know, it's like, where is this going? It's not going anywhere. But where's it going? It's not. Nope, nothing's going to happen. So it's a challenge if you're not ready for ambient.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough, a shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older.
So So do you have any Pop Matters on your mind as you sit there recovering from?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. And I haven't been listening to much new stuff at all between travel and... Let me say one thing. Over the winter break, when I was in Chicago, my mom and I were given tickets to go see Hamilton, the musical in Chicago.
Ah.
And Chicago was the first city that Lin-Manuel Miranda took the show to. It's still on Broadway, but the Chicago production has been getting rave reviews, and they're sold out through September, I think, of this year. And my mom was nervous because she heard there was rapping. And for me, this musical, something I've wanted to see and I'm kind of interested in seeing. And I thought, wow, you know, American history, rap, I'm there. I got this. I'm not going to have any problems with this. But I can understand my mother's frustration. So I went and got her the original cast recording, double CD, so she could listen to it beforehand. And she realized, yes, there's rapping, but it's not. If I put in my hearing aids and pay attention, this will go well. And then when you see everything in context, it all makes perfect sense. And the rapping doesn't, it's literally a show for all ages. Although, you know, Motherfucker is dropped with some, I wouldn't say frequency, but with some consistency in the show, right? Anyway, so I saw Hamilton. And the first thing I want to say is, it is fucking awesome. Everything you've heard about it is not enough. I am totally all in on this fucking musical. I think it's brilliant. And I found it incredibly powerful, incredibly moving, drop-dead smart, and musically fascinating. And so the closest thing I have to Pop Matters would be the double CD of the cast recording. And having seen the show now, it's on high rotation right now on my music delivery device. I love this fucking musical, and I think it's got a handful of great numbers. And there's only one or two numbers that I find that I have an indifferent reaction to. So for those who don't know, it tells the story of one of the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, and it tells the story of his life. It turns out, you know, Hamilton had his fingers in a shit ton of pies from the Revolution to the early years of our nation. And the musical just essentially, you know, tells the story of his life, the arc of his life. And the music is so good. And the guy has, he does this brilliant thing where he adapts the style of the song to the context and to who's delivering it. So just to give you a couple of examples. During cabinet debates, so we have a couple of cabinet debates where Washington is allowing members of his cabinet to argue with each other. So Hamilton was on his cabinet, and, right? So these are early cabinet debates about, you know, the need for a bank. So it turns into a rap battle. And that's just fucking, I mean, that's just a great choice. It makes perfect sense in that context for, you know, guys to call each other out and literally drop the mic. It's great. I mean, you're just like, yes, this is really smart. Another example is, and you have to kind of have a little familiarity with contemporary pop music, but Alexander Hamilton fell in love with one of three daughters who were daughters of a wealthy colonial man named Schuyler. And so there are three daughters, Angelica, Eliza, and Peggy, and they get a couple of numbers, the three of them, and they're done like Destiny's Child.
Oh, okay.
It's just, it's fucking the harmonies, the head movements, the way they talk. I mean, he just told them, okay, you're Beyonce. I mean, he just told them you're doing Destiny's Child. And it's fucking, it's just genius. You're just like, oh my God, that's so good. And one more example. In Act 2, the first act takes place up to, you know, basically the Revolution. No, two more examples. And then in Act 2, Jefferson, who's been the ambassador to France, he comes back. And so when Act 2 opens, he gets an opening number called What I Miss. And he's been told, I think pretty clearly, you are now Prince. And it's like a three-minute Prince rave-up. It is fucking brilliant. I mean, it's just, he just owns the stage, and it's a Prince number. It's just a Prince, I'm going to get you out of your seat, shaking. It's just genius, the way that number. And in fact, he has him dressed in purple, in case you didn't get the point. It's just, you're just like, oh my God, this is so fucking smart. And then there's three numbers in the musical by King George. He comes out by himself on the stage three different times. And the first time he comes out, it's when the Revolutionary War started. So he's by himself. You know, the whole musical is, there's almost no dialogue. I mean, it's just song segues into song. It's almost pure music. So everyone leaves and he walks out in robe and ermine and cape and crown and scepter. And he does this song. It's basically, the song is called You'll Be Back, right? And it's done as a British invasion breakup song. And of course, he's a British invader, right? So doing it as a British invasion pop song is fucking genius. So the chorus is just sounds like something from the Beatles. It sounds like something from Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's. You're just like, oh my God. And it's a show-stopping number because, you know, he talks about how, you know, I'm your man. You've turned your back on me. I'll do whatever it takes to win your love. He says, I'll send over armed battalions to kill your families and loved ones for my love. It's just, it's a standing ovation number. It's a little 3-minute piece. And you're just like, oh my God, that's just so smart. It's just a smart musical. And those are the kinds of choices he makes. It's got an eclectic set of musical styles and he matches the music to what's happening. So, you know, British invasion pop for George III, it's just genius. It's just fucking genius. After the revolution or when during that song, he says, you know, so you'll be independent. And then so he's got this really clipped British accent, which is quite funny. And he says, so you'll be free now. Awesome. Wow. sort of slips into this American. And it's just, these are show-stopping numbers. The ovations after each number. And, you know, our seats, these are very expensive seats to get. It's very hard to get a ticket to this show. I Googled before the show started just to see what our seats would have sold for if we had sold them on the black market or whatever. Our seats, which probably cost originally like $150, and I don't know what my brother paid for them, were retailing our seats. We're the fourth row from the back, nosebleed seats, $2,500
each. Oh, good Lord. Wow.
I know. This is a hard ticket to get. But if you get a ticket to see it, go see it. I found it utterly moving. I've only given a handful of standing ovations in my life because I think they have to be earned. I'm that asshole who sits when everyone else is standing because I just don't feel it. But I can count the number of times where I've stood up and just given enthusiastic applause. And this is one of them. The end of this thing was so moving. I swear to God, I had tears. I mean, there was tears on my face. I was like, fuck. It was so good. It was so good. Yeah, I love the music from this thing. It's on heavy rotation, and I can't sing its praises highly enough. I'm desperate to go again, although yeah, I can't afford it. So I would love to have a seat where I could see them, although, you know, you don't really have to. I mean, we could see perfectly fine. It's just now I know why people have opera glasses.
Yeah, there you go.
Highest praise for this show, and if you can't see it, get the cast recording. It's sublime.
Yeah, somebody got it for me. I still have not found the occasion to play it, so I really should make an effort. Because it's a solid wall of words. They're unfamiliar to me, so I'd have to find a time that I do nothing but listen to it. But someday I really should do that. Yeah, we looked into getting tickets. I think, you know, every now and then I take Rand and sometimes Catherine and come and go look at some theater in Chicago, but of course they were just out of range. But, you know, there is a place called Beef and Boards in Covington, Indiana, and so when the production comes there, we're definitely going to see it in 2037. It'll be great. Yeah, real quickly, I listened. I kind of had vaguely said that I thought what Kamasi Washington was doing sounded to me like stuff from the 70s. I don't think I had a specific model in mind, but then I got a box set of the early albums of Lonnie Liston Smith, who I ignorantly did not know was a different person from Lonnie Smith. Silly me. He's a different player. And his Cosmic Jazz is absolutely the fucking template for Kamasi Washington. I mean, it's like, oh, okay. This is what I was thinking of. So I have not dug real deep into it. It's fine stuff. It's not brilliant music. But in terms of just that feel, this is the closest analog I found in the actual period to what Kamasi is doing now. It's not identical. I'm not saying there's no changes. And I think Kamasi is a more interesting player than some of the musicians on some of these albums. But anyway, it was just, I found the Motherlode. Now, I don't know whether Kamasi's heard him or not.
Right.
But if he hasn't, it's a fucking coincidence. So anyway, and if you're interested in those, I could get them to you at some point. If you remember the B-52s, Cindy Wilson was one of the singers. And eMusic was promoting her album, Change. And it's pretty good. As a singer, she's not amazing. It's more about the good hooks and the melodies and the production. Apparently, she hooked up with three younger musicians, and they kind of put together a project with her, and she co-wrote with them. But the results are by no means, you know, kind of, I don't know, embarrassing or low energy or kind of flat. They work pretty well. But it's kind of, it's got an electronic edge. There's a little guitar on one number, but it's, you know, it's decent adult pop. It's not going to blow your mind, or she hasn't suddenly become Screaming Lord Sutch or something, but it was a good record rather than a mediocre one. So I was kind of happy that worked out for her. And I never heard of Larkin Poe, but if you can imagine the Black Keys and now imagine their two cute white girls, they're a little bit like that. I think they came more from the folk side, but they're moving towards the rock side. And they do the song Black Betty, a song I never heard of till I saw it on a video game. I'm not sure two white girls should sing the song Black Betty or Robert Johnson tunes, but there's other ones that are more rocky. And it's just, they don't quite, the vocalist, I'm not sure whether it's both or one of them that sings, but not quite the grit you need to completely be convincing of the idiom. But it's overall, it's successful, it's fine. I would certainly enjoy seeing them live. Again, just kind of an eMusic saying, well, what about this? And I said, okay, what the hell, I'll try it. And, you know, not bad. So that's just another, I guess I wasn't aware again that there were other people out. Again, they're probably coming more towards the Black Keys sound from the folk angle rather than wherever the Black Keys come from, the swamp or whatever. But they're starting to converge. And it was, you know, it was entertaining. So that's what I've been listening to recently. And that concludes this special All Dancing, All Rapping, episode 133 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. We do appreciate hearing from you and your ideas for the podcast. Please keep those coming. It's nice not podcasting into a void, although ultimately we know we are. You can download the podcast at www.jazzbastard.com or from Apple Podcasts, or if you prefer, you could wait for our monthly summary appearing on All About Jazz. Tune in next time when we discuss works provided to us by the Two for the Show media firm in an effort to promote some of their younger, lesser-known artists. We're going to talk about works by Syrinx Effect, Elliot Mason, Ryan Marr, and Aaron Araneta. Until next time, take care.
I think I mentioned to you, or perhaps I didn't, that someone finally explained to me that I never see my neighbors downstairs, but I only occasionally hear a human voice in the throes of ecstasy. Because there's a studio directly below mine, second floor, and there's the layout of both doors is the same, so they're directly below. And I've never seen this woman, but I have infrequently heard her, and I can tell you a great deal about, you know, what she sounds like in her moments of passion. But I've never seen this person, and I never see anyone go in and out of that apartment. And finally, one of my colleagues said, well, it's a sugar shack. It's a honey hut. And I'm like, what does that mean? And they're like, it's where someone meets their mistress. And I thought, of course it is. Because I know what my rent is, which is pretty low. And it's near downtown. So clearly some lawyer or doctor has the place stocked with Viagra and champagne and oysters and brings his mistress here. Or it could be her brings her mistress here. I don't know. Anyway, I know that the person who's having the most fun is female. I can at least confirm that.
Okay.
And yeah, and that's why I never see anyone, and I only occasionally hear someone in moments of passion.
Well, it's a relief, because the other explanation that occurred to me was she's dating a ghost. So at least there's an explanation there. Thank God.
Well, I've never seen her, so maybe she's the ghost. I don't know. Maybe they're both ghosts.
She's a sex ghost.
Yeah, I've never heard that term. A honey hut. A sugar shack.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like a B-52 song somehow.